Let's look at Daniel chapter 1, and I want to review. Dakota's going to bring this up on the screen. Let me just quickly review the last part on this page. We're talking about the first of three, and we'll introduce the second one this morning. The first of three truths that if you're going to live spiritually in a secular or an unspiritual world, that you need as a believer, the first thing is you need a commitment to the Lord Jesus Christ, commitment to God. And we see that with these four men here in Daniel chapter 1. And we are looking at what does this mean for us today? That's what we ended last week. And we said that the Babylonians could change their names. They couldn't change their character. And what does it mean for us today? The enemy may tell us to change. They may even call us names and insult us. But we must remain strong and resolute. We must resolve to the commitment in doing right. Even when the odds seem stacked against us, we must resolve to stand for God in the future. Standing and commitment to God is not just for today. Standing and commitment for God, as you're going to see with these men who are now older in Daniel chapter 3, it wasn't a one-time decision. It's a lifetime commitment. A commitment to Christ, is a lifetime commitment. Number three, faithfulness to God, a total commitment to God, must be at the center of how we live our lives, no matter how bad this world becomes. And now is the time for this commitment. Today and yesterday, I hope. And then we talked about fleeing idolatry. And we ended with a couple of verses in the New Testament that the writers of the New Testament talked about that. Let's continue here in verse number 9. And we started talking about it, but we want to look at the fourth thing in our outline underneath the commitment of these young men. Is we see that there is a counter offer requested. The king's assistant had appointed a daily provision of meat and wine that had been offered to these idols, and Daniel had resolved, and his friends, I believe, in their hearts long before, that they would not defile themselves, and ultimately that they would not defile God and his name. And he say, in verse number 9, the Bible, Daniel writes, God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse than the children which are of your kind or sort? Then shall you endanger my head to the king. Then Daniel said to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over these four men, prove, test thy servants, I beseech these, for 10 days, and let them give us pulsed and water to drink, and let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat, and as thou seest, deal with thy servants. And so he consented to them in this matter, and he tested them 10 days. There's a lot here that's going on. But the first thing that I want you to note is that God, specifically God, had taken and brought Daniel into a place that he could even ask such a request. This was the doing of God. Notice the words favor and tender love. This word, this phrase, tender love, which means compassionate love, is the Hebrew word hesed, which we see used over and over in the Old Testament for the steadfast, loyal love of God. You see, God specifically had raised up these men for this time. I think of a story in the book of Esther, and I don't even know the verse, what reference it is. You can look it up by just Googling it or looking it up in your concordance. But I remember there's a verse that says something like this: for such a time as this. For such a time as this. I believe that God had specifically set Daniel and his friends in this place and at this location, at this time in human history, to be able to take a stand for him. And they made the choice, verse 8 tells us, to do exactly that. And in doing so, God took these men, specifically Daniel here in verse 9, but I think all four of them, and brought them into such a place that they could ask a request to do exactly opposite of what the king commanded. That is no small thing. Again, we think of Esther when she and what she had to do in order to save the people of Israel. To do something that was no small task. To go against the greatest man at this time in human history, at the time that this is unfolding, to do and ask an opposite request is not something you did every day, because it most likely endangered your life. In fact, you'll notice in verse number 10, you'll notice that the assistant, Melzar, to Ashpenaz, the one that was specifically over this group of young men, recognized that if he were to switch up the appointed food, that his life was in danger. How exactly Daniel went about this, I don't know. We can assume that he didn't pull out his picket sign and stand on the union line of the young men and put up the sign and said, "I'm going to resist. I am not going to eat this meat." And he had it on a big sign, said, "I will not do it." I'm guessing that's not the way he went about it. But some way and in some matter, Daniel and his friends showed that they cared enough about where they lived, even though this was not their original home, that they said, "We want to not disrespect the king, but we would ask that we would not have to obey this request, and we will give you a separate counter offer." Notice here, after the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I'm afraid of the king who hath given you this appointing of meat and wine to drink. And he was afraid for a physical reason. Notice this. He was afraid that the people, these young men, would not look good. You know what, Daniel? I don't think really at this point cared so much about whether he looked good. He cared that God looked good. Now, did he care? Yes, in some sense. I'm sure he wanted to do and appear good. But when you think about what he's asking to eat and to drink, compared to the king's meat, he's probably not going to appear quite as fair and fat looking and good looking, maybe. But it didn't matter to Daniel. So it says here in verse 10, you've appointed this meat and this drink. Melzar is concerned about his own life. He's concerned about their looks. He's concerned about that you're going to look worse than all the others, which are the other young people, the other children that are just like you. You're going to look worse, and you're not going to be able to fulfill, and that's going to fall on me. I'm in charge of this group. I'm in charge of you. That's going to fall on me. Not only are you not going to look good, I'm not going to look good, and I'm not even going to be alive to tell about it. That's what verse 10 is telling us. But Daniel said to Melzar, Daniel didn't give up. Daniel didn't say, "Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right, we won't look as good." And yes, and I'm sure he felt he didn't want to see Melzar killed. He didn't want to see Melzar's head cut off, okay? But he says to Melzar, he doesn't give up. He says, "Run this test for 10 days, just 10 days, just a short time." Now, 10 days compared to 3 years, the original test was going to last 3 years. We saw that last week. 10 days, not much is going to change in 10 days. Now, if I drink just water and eat just vegetables for 10 days, I will look different at the end of 10 days. But, if you weren't, I'm a little bit, I could do that and it would be good for me. But, I can't imagine that these guys were, bad looking to start with. Where I might be if I did it for 10 days. They were teenage young men, handsome, I'm sure. That's why they were probably picked to start with. So to do this would, in some sense, make him maybe not look as good. That makes sense, what Melzar said. He says, let our countenances, verse 13, look at them at the end. Look at our faces and compare us. And amazingly, look at what happened in verse 14. Melzar agreed to the test. Do you think if Daniel and his three Hebrew friends rolled in there and they came in there and said, we are not going to do this? Just give us meat? Shook their fists at him? What do you think would have happened to him? I don't think they would have survived. From what I know about Nebuchadnezzar and the things that we're going to learn about the fiery furnace today, my guess is that if they had done it that way, it wouldn't have worked. Their lives would have been ended. But God had brought them into this tender, compassionate love with the prince of the eunuchs. They had treated him kindly. I'm convinced of it. So much that he agreed to consent to give this test to them. Even though he knew it would not only endanger their lives, it would endanger his life. That's pretty amazing. God's at work here. Don't miss it. So he consented them in this matter, and he tested them 10 days. Let's see the results of the test, verses 15 through the end of the chapter. And at the end of the 10 days, and this is the next point, is the results of the test. At the end of the 10 days, their countenances appear fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat of the portion of the king's meat. And Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink, and he gave them the pulse, the vegetables. As for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill and all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And notice that it is God that gave him all of this. It is God that did this. Now, at the end of the days, the king had said he should bring them in. So the end of the 3 years, the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king communed with them. And among them, all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all his magicians and astrologers that were in his realm. And Daniel continued under the first year of King Cyrus. Let me say this in a nutshell about all that happens in chapter 1. If Daniel and his friends had not purposed in their hearts as young people to do what is right, I don't believe God would have used them in the ways that he uses them the rest of the book. I said this last week. Now is the time as a young person to make the choices to follow God and be committed to God. Do not wait and say, you know what, I'm going to commit to God, you know, after I have the fun years of whatever, you know, the young 20s. The young 20s and 30s, which some of us who are now in our 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, it's all gone and it's gone quickly. Don't waste your life thinking that, you know what, I'm going to wait to commit to Christ. God will not use you when you're not committed to him fully. And Daniel, as we unpack the rest of the things that we want to study in this book, and we're just touching some of the major stories. There's so much more in the book of Daniel. But Daniel and his friends did this when they knew it was right to do, and they stood by it, and God used them. Daniel and his three friends look better, but let me tell you, by the way, they graduated with the highest honors, the best GPA, and they excelled above anyone or anyone else could have ever imagined. What gives, by the way? How did this happen? Was it because they drank water? Were the vegetables, I mean, there's some good vegetables, and you know, homegrown vegetables are better than store-bought vegetables and et cetera, you know. You can go to the store and buy some vegetables and they just taste horrible. But you know, if you have certain types, like homegrown carrots, just they're really good. Now, you know, some carrots, you know, we bought a bag, 10-pound bag of carrots. Judy bought it this week at Winco. We go through carrots at our house like crazy. I try to eat 2 to 3 carrots a day at my house for lunch. It's what part of my lunch routine when I'm home. And so we go through them like crazy, and we've gone up from the 5 to the 10-pound bag. And, you know, we were still finishing up carrots from the garden. And those carrots from the garden, even though they've been in the wind, still out there for quite a while, you pull them out and they taste better than the Winco carrots. That makes sense? And so, but was it that these vegetables were the best of the best, and that's why Daniel was so smart? No! Verse 17 tells us it was God. It was all God, God who was sovereignly in control of their lives, of these young men. They had made the right choice, and God used them. But it was God. And so the application is clear for us. This was the conclusion to last week's sermon that I didn't get to. As we continue to spiral away from God's plan as a nation, as we live in an increasingly secular world, we must prepare ourselves to be full-time followers for the Lord. We must be full-time followers of the Lord. How do we do that? We remain strong and resolute in our commitment to do right. We do right till the stars fall, the song goes. We resolve now to stand for God today, but as Daniel, as we're going to see in this sermon today, also in the future, no matter how bad it gets, like Jeremiah, like Isaiah, like Paul, like the disciples in the early church, like so many missionaries down and so many godly people who we don't know the names, like the Jim Elliots, but so many others that are not famous like Jim Elliot is, who have stood in the midst of places like the China and the Boxer Rebellion, where Christians were tortured and killed, like places like Cambodia and North Korea, where Christians are willing to give their life. We resolve, like they have resolved, to stand for God no matter how bad it gets. We resolve, thirdly, to remain faithful to God, and we resolve to flee idolatry. Because idolatry is what takes us away from commitment to God. Whatever the idol is, when you're not committed to God, something has taken its place or his place. It might be your car, it might be your money, it might be your kids, it might be whatever it is. And Daniel and his friends said, no, we're not going to follow the idols. Now let's turn to our second message here as we go into part two. Still the same title of the message. But as we turn to Daniel chapter 3 this morning, and as we think about an increasingly secular world, where God has become marginalized at best and rejected at worst, we are going to find our lives faced with important spiritual decisions at every turn. You know, for the last couple hundred years in America, it has seemingly been a place where, you know, spiritual decisions maybe weren't very important. Now, they were, and they should have been, but in the church today, spiritual decisions are taken very lightly. To follow God and the proper words here, as we find in the Bible, is taken lightly. God's name is taken lightly by Christians. So-called Christians that use God's name as flippantly as they use words in their daily language and treat him like he's dirt. But now, as we grow increasingly secular and God is being rejected in our country, every choice that you as a believer will be scrutinized under a microscope. It's the public microscope. And we're going to find here in this chapter today that three Hebrew men were placed under the public microscope. And they were forced to show to all the people that day that they were true followers of Jehovah. There was no hiding it. They couldn't hide behind some four walls of their home. No, they were part of the large crowd. And I'm going to guess that everybody there that day knew eventually they had not bowed. Their lives were threatened, their faith was tested, but they stood amidst all others who bowed. What will it be for us as we face this increasing public scrutiny in America? I believe the life of Daniel and his three Hebrew friends can be summarized in one succinct phrase: faith in Jehovah. Last time in chapter 1, we saw the four demonstrating an unwavering commitment to God and his law. On the other hand, if you look in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar, who had seen Daniel interpret his dream, desired pride and all to worship his likeness. That's what we're going to see unfold today. And when you compare the simple faith of Daniel and his friends to the pride of the secular world leaders, the chasm couldn't be greater. And the difference between the two groups demonstrates a flawed view of the Lord versus a faith-filled trust in God. What do you have today? Where are we today? What is your view of God? What was the difference? Nebuchadnezzar saw his gods as more important than God. His view of himself was warped, and he thought he could do anything that he pleased. Didn't Nebuchadnezzar find out differently? And let me tell you, every single person that thinks God is not God and that they are better than God is going to find out, whether it's in this life or the next. God will not be mocked. He will not be deceived. What is wonderful, though, that God made himself known to the Gentiles in this chapter, didn't he? Even though the Jews were the primary vehicle and most of the Bible is about them, God showed himself over and over to Gentiles in the scripture. Think of Pharaoh in Egypt. Did God make himself known to that man? Think of Jonah and Nineveh. And here in the book of Daniel, we find that God reveals himself to the wicked king. So we're talking about living spiritually in a secular world. That's the title, of this message. Let's look, second of all, in Daniel chapter 3 at the second main truth. If we're going to live spiritually in a secular world, the second main truth is that we must have courage. And we find, number two, the courage of the Hebrew young men. The courage of the Hebrew young men. You know the story well. Some of the most well-known stories, Bible stories for kids, are found in the book of Daniel, aren't they? Two of the most well-known stories. When you pull them, we find the fiery furnace and the lion's den. But let me tell you, just like Noah's Ark is often given the wrong look and the wrong spin, I've told you this before, Noah's Ark, when you look at the kids' books, it's a bathtub, an overlarge bathtub boat full of plastic animals sticking out. You know, the giraffes are sticking out and elephants, and you got two of every kind. And it looks like the kid's book, it looks like this fun party boat with all these animals. And we kind of think of the fiery furnace and the lion's den as just really good stories. You know what this story today is? The ultimate clash between the demonic forces of the devil and the courageous commitment to God and his sovereign will. That's what this story is about. That's what Daniel in the lion's den is going to be about. Who will win out? It wasn't just about somebody surviving a furnace. That's kind of the good part of the story. They survived. That's not the main part of the story, is that these men survived the fiery furnace. But more importantly, they are a 100% sold out group who boldly worship God and believe that he will always win in the end. Let's unpack the story today. First of all, and we're just going to do part of the story today, the first the verses that Doug read, we'll finish it next week. The first two parts to this story. First, we find the command to worship the king's statue. And each of these have an R word that go with them, each of my points today. There's a command to worship the king's statue. There's a demand for reverence. Now, it's not the right reverence that for God, the true God, but it is a veneration and worship of this image. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and the breadth of 6 cubits, and he set it in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now that's lots of key information there. We'll come back to it in just a moment. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes and the governors and all these groups of people to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then this group of people, the princes, the governors, and all these different higher-ups were gathered together under the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that when you hear all this music, you are to fall down, and note this, worship the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship the same hour will be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the instruments and all the people of the nations, they fell down and they worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Do you realize that the theme that is unfolding in this chapter is the exact same theme that unfolded in chapter 1? And will be the same theme that unfolds in chapter 6 when we look at it about Daniel and the lion's den. And here it is. It's the same thing. Here it is. This is what it is. Are you going to worship God? Or are you going to worship anybody else? Remember chapter 1? Why was it that Daniel had purposed in his heart? Why was it that he did not want to drink? It's because they had been offered to what? Idols. Because he knew it would be a disgrace of the worship of Jehovah to eat and drink of something that had been offered to idols. It was as if they were going to worship that. You know what it is again? These men are going to make a choice to worship God. And when Daniel goes to pray 3 times a day, even though there had been a specific decree against him, he chose to do what? Worship God. This is all about whether you are truly going to be committed and truly worship God. Now, obviously, it takes courage. The king had erected a statue, verse 1. We don't know what the statue looked like. I mean, we can kind of come up. I just put the legs up, but the first picture, you know, we could guess. We don't know if the statue was of himself. Scholars kind of think it may have been himself. But whatever it was a statue that he had designed, and we could think it was him, and it could have been as a result of chapter 2 in the dream that he had. But whatever it was some probably human form, and it was probably overlaid with gold. The dimensions of the statue, get this, were 90 feet tall. Okay, I'm trying to think what's 90 feet tall in this city. I'm thinking the Dairy Gold building's a little bit taller than 90 feet. That's 120. So maybe 3/4?
You know the red one? The one with the red cap?
That's okay. About 90 feet. Okay. So 90 feet tall. And now it's kind of a weird looking thing because it's only 9 feet wide. But set up in the plain, chapter 1. Notice it's put in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. It probably could be seen for miles. Could be seen. You know, you can see the tower coming in. And now it's obviously larger than 9 feet wide. But you can see these things coming before you get to Linden. So this image was set up. And no matter who the statue was depicting, it was an idolatrous replacement of the true God. Anyone that bowed the knee then acknowledged that this golden idol was God. Daniel chapter 2, verse 46. Notice this, after Daniel had interpreted the dream of the different part to the different kingdoms that were upcoming, one of which was the kingdom of Babylon, he says, "Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshiped Daniel and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him." Interesting that the king worshiped Daniel after Daniel told him. And then he turns around and he makes this image of gold. Probably not solid gold, probably overlaid with gold. Could be of himself, that makes sense. But whatever it was to the Hebrew men an opportunity to worship someone other than the true God that they believed in. The king now demands a host of political advisors, rulers, and administrative agents to come to the dedication of this golden god. And it appears, in my belief, that the king wanted to make a statement of political unity as well as religious, a religious statement, that he was the sole over authority over all the lands that he controlled. Now, I say a political unity because you notice what the group of people, look at the names, notice who he brings. He brings political rulers. He brings the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs. He brings them all. And those are all, you know, today we kind of think of those as political offices. You know what he's doing? He's merging the political entity with the religious. And he's saying that when you come and you're going to worship this image, and if it was him, and probably was a depiction of him, but again, that's conjecture. He is saying, I am the authority over everything. If you are going to bow down, you are going to worship me. I'm going to be in control of all the political. I'm going to be in control of the religious. He's going to mix them all together, and I am the greatest. That's what he's saying. And you will worship me. And if you don't worship me, what's going to happen? Well, he says, verse number 6, who does not fall down and worship shall the same hour, we're not going to wait a couple of days, that same hour will be cast and killed in the midst of the fiery furnace. So he gathers all these people. Let me say this, I don't think that every single person that lived in Babylon came that day. That would have been a monumental task. These were representatives of the different locations that the people lived, and these representatives represented all the locals. And basically, as representatives, they were saying that all the subordinates under us would agree to worship this image. They would agree that Nebuchadnezzar's image was the crowning point here, and to worship was to say, we agreed. And they were representing all of the people of Babylon. And so they were to hear the music, all these different instruments, and they were to fall down and they were to worship this golden image. And the penalty was extremely stiff if you chose not to obey. This wasn't, you know, if you're caught drinking and driving, you'll get one slap on your wrist, you know, and eventually you'll lose your license, and, you know, you may go to jail if you do it enough times. You say, Pastor Ray, you mean if they didn't take a few seconds to bow down? A few seconds. What, a minute or two, three at most? They'd be killed. Well, that's what the Bible tells us. This was not some small, insignificant penalty slap on the wrist. This was, if you do not worship the image that I have set up, you will die. Now, I don't know this to be a fact. Obviously, it would have taken some time for that image to be built. I have no proof of this. But I'm going to wager a guess that these men did not make the decision to bow and not to bow at the moment the music began. You say, well, Pastor Randy, how do you know that? Because Daniel 1:8 tells us that. That as young men, they had already faced this. They had already faced the possibility. These men had been through so much already that they had resolved that they were going to not eat of the king's meat, that they were willing to put their lives on the line for that test. While this test was a ratcheting up, so to speak, this was much bigger. And not just a few people would know that they hadn't done eaten the king's meat. Now all the people that were bowing that day and these men were going to be put on a public display, it would be obvious that these men hadn't bowed when they were cast into the fiery furnace. Everybody would know that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had not obeyed the king's command to worship something other than Jehovah. And so they had decided long before that first note was played on the sackbut or the cornet or whatever the instruments, the dulcimer, the psaltery, the flute. I don't even know what all these instruments are. I didn't spend time looking at them. But that first note was played. Those men, I just don't believe those men thought, should we not? Should we? Oh, I hear that music. Should we not? No, they had resolved. They knew. That's commitment and that's courage for Christ. This was not a political show. It was a deeply, this was of deeply religious significance to the king, even though it included politicians. But even a young child, like most of the young children here, can grasp the consequences if they didn't obey the king's command. My kids, every one of us, every single one of us, unless you're just a little baby, even Henry probably could understand that if they didn't listen, they would go into a place that wouldn't feel very good and they would die. It's increasingly clear that if anyone challenged the king's authority, he would face certain death. Nebuchadnezzar was demanding total allegiance to him as supreme ruler. Whether it is or is his image or not is not the point here. Rather, the fact that he demands religious worship with an image at the center of his known universe, this plane in Babylon. The matter is that he demanded this religious worship. Let me quote this. The herald addressed the officials as peoples, nations, and men of every language, apparently considering the officials as representatives of the peoples over whom they ruled. So the officials' act of obedience signified submission not only by the officials themselves, but signified submission, but also by the people that they ruled. Well, let's look here, second of all. So there is an attempt by the king to make everyone reverence this golden image. Number two, there's the complaint of the Chaldeans against the Hebrew men. There is a refusal. Look at verse 8. It says, "Wherefore at the time certain Chaldeans," that's Babylonians, "came near, and they accused the Jews. They spoke and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of these instruments and all the kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso does not fall down and worship, he will be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace.'" And king, whether you realize it or not, Nebuchadnezzar, we were peeking. We wanted to see if those Jews, and I'm thinking that they knew these guys because of what had happened in chapter 1. These were prominent. Daniel and his friends were prominent people. And as we're going to see in chapter 6, these Babylonian high-ups did not like the fact that Daniel was a high-up as a Jew. We'll see that in chapter 6. But they said to the king, we wanted to make sure that your word was being obeyed. So we just took a look. Well, now we bowed, but out of the corner of our eyes, as we were bowing, by the way, bowing means you go, all the way to the ground, probably the heads were down. That's the idea of bowing. But, we kind of peeked up and there are some people over there, way over yonder. They kind of stood out like sore thumbs because there was only three of them. And king, we want you to know that there are certain Jews, those three, who you set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded you, have not listened to you, and they, watch this, they don't serve your gods. They will not worship the golden image which thou hast set up. This is as far as we're going to go today. As far as I know, every single person obeyed that day except these three men. Now, it's possible that there was a few others. But as far as the Jewish nation, I would have assumed that all of those would have been recorded in this book. So these three, while virtually every single person else bowed that day, and you'll notice the word accusation. They accused there. They made an accusation. And that word is strong. It's a malicious. It's a malicious. Means malicious and literally to tear into pieces. They came to the king and reminded him of his decree. And they appealed to his pride. Notice that in verse number 12. They said, "O king, they have not listened to you." You know, they haven't done what you said to do. They haven't followed the decree. They refused to bow down and worship. And you said, if they didn't listen to you, king, oh, live forever, you know, king, you would get rid of them. And we kind of want to see them get rid of too. So, they were demonstrating that the very king's authority was being challenged. His pride and ego were being defied. And you know, we aren't going to see the end of the story today. You know the end of the story. And we know who's going to win out. But at this moment, things don't look very good for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It looks like that they are going to end up in the fiery furnace. It looks like that this king is going to win out. Do you know in the book of Daniel, we are reminded, just like in the book of Exodus over and over, that where it looks like the human king is going to win out, in the end, God always wins out. So they appealed to his pride. They emphasized that the king himself was the one that had made this decree, and that he himself said those who refused to bow and worship would be thrown into this furnace. If you look back at chapter 2 and verse number 49, I think, at least it's my belief, that these men were jealous of the positions that these men had gotten into the kingdom. Look at verse 49, last verse of chapter 2. Daniel requested of the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. You see, when Daniel had been promoted, he asked specifically that his three friends be able to be given positions of leadership in the affairs of the province of Babylon. And notice here, because the question is, where was Daniel in all of this? Why isn't he mentioned? Why, you know, did he bow? I don't even think he was there that day, frankly. He sat in the gate of the king. And we know if he had been there, he wouldn't have bowed. That's my belief. Because of Daniel 1:8. Because of Daniel chapter 6, because of the whole book. I don't think he was there that day. Were these men being disloyal to the king? Was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego saying, you know what, we just really want to shove it in his face? No. They weren't being disloyal. This was not about disloyalty to a king. It was about loyalty to Jehovah. They had served him well, no doubt. But in this, they were demonstrating it was more important to obey God rather than man. They were being completely loyal to Jehovah God. Let me show you one more thing, and then I'm going to close. The meat of this comes in the next section, the next couple of sections. But I think you're getting the picture of what is happening here. Let me just show you a couple of things in the next section. Verse 13, and then I'll close. Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they brought these men before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar spoke unto them and said, is it true? I find this fascinating that the king asks a question. Doesn't accuse him, he asks them, and he's going to get them to admit. He puts them into a tough spot. He doesn't say, well, my friend said. No, he said, is this true? I think there was a measure of trust that Nebuchadnezzar had for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He said, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not you serve my gods? Do you not worship this golden image which I have set up? Now, if you re-ready that at what time you hear the sound of the instruments, that you fall down and worship the image which I have made, well, but if you worship not, you will be cast the same hour into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? That is exactly what Pharaoh said in Exodus to Moses. He said, who is your God to come against my gods? That's what Nebuchadnezzar was saying. Who is your God to come against my gods? You can close your Bible. So I don't want to reveal more about this story. We'll save it for next week. But I want to tell you that is the exact same thinking that is unfolding in America today. What is it that groups of people are saying? Atheists, agnostics, the secular world, they're saying to you, who is your God to stand up against us? They may not say it exactly that way, but that is the way that they are acting towards us. They're saying, and they're mocking the God that we serve. Saying, who's your God? He's not stronger and more powerful than all we have. Let me tell you, if you think that way today, you need to wise up today. Judgment day will come. And we must decide now to have the courage of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Let me tell you, there are many people down through history that have had the courage of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That have been decided that when they were told, and many have given their lives because of it, that when they were said, you renounce God or you die, they said, we will not renounce God. We will not worship you, king of whatever country they lived in. What's it going to be for you? What's it going to be for you? Let's close.